A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You know, we're in the 21st century here, and the question still for people of color, for African Americans, is what is selling out? And there is no show. In fact, the career of my guest, Kenya Barris, has sort of dealt with that from his running the show The Game, which is also a show that dealt with the question of people of color and what selling out really means. And his show that he's now currently in his third season, the show he created for ABC, Blackish, very much deals with that in a comedic fashion. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, man.
And it really is about that, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a battle. Because for so long, you know, we had nothing. And then we had something. And then it was the people, you know, if it was Young MC or Will Smith, it was, you know, that was, are they selling out? Are they kind of, you know, and then it was people kind of, you know, the Jay-Z's and the Tupac's of the world sort of made their own lane. It was kind of anti-establishment.
But they were still, very much Jay-Z was still selling things. At the same time, he was decrying other people who sold out.
Absolutely. But he became, you know, almost I consider him, you know, an idol of mine, but he became a godfather in that he made them buy what he wanted to sell, you know, rather than having them being the powers that be, having them dictate what was going to be sold. And so I think now, you know, the current flock of things that are going on, you know, I look at Issa and I look at Donald Glover and I look at Courtney Kemp and just, you know, there's this people coming up, there's a lane, and you know, it's interesting that I happen to sort of be friendly with all of them. There's a lane that we're trying to sort of walk where it's now maybe our time to dictate what we're doing, but we know now that there is a sort of an aggregate lane that has to sort of go between being what we want to do, but we also want to be of the system, so we have to sort of combine the two.
It's interesting, though, because all those shows you're talking about, you mentioned the creators of Insecure and Atlanta and, of course,
Power.
Power,
yeah.
And Courtney's done the show.
Mm-hmm. I love Courtney.
Yeah, well, we love her here, too. These are all shows that one way or another deal with that aspect of what happens when you become successful,
mm-hmm.
or the threat of the prospect of success,
mm-hmm.
and how you negotiate who you are versus success,
mm-hmm.
which is, going back to the talented 10th,
yes.
has been a question in black culture, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And we're there now. And I feel like it is, for me personally, you know, coming from inner city Los Angeles and having a situation now where I'm raising kids in a not inner city Los Angeles and trying, that's sort of what my show is about. And at the same time, looking at the landscape of what politics is today and look at the landscape of what just society is today, I feel like it is a constant sort of push-pull between the story I want to tell and the story I feel like I can tell and the story that really has to be told. Like, that's sort of...
How do you negotiate that between those three pressure points?
I feel like the best way that I sort of learned to deal with it is just being earnest and honest. You know, being, like, honest to what I feel like. Because if I feel like I'm telling an honest story, I don't necessarily, all the other questions kind of go out the door, because I feel like if I'm telling a story that I feel like is the most true and sincere form of what those characters that I'm speaking the voice through are saying, then really I don't have any apologies to make in that aspect, because I'm like, that's really what they would be saying. And if you don't like it, I'm sorry. And if you do, fantastic, but at least I can, you know, sleep at night saying that I'm trying to tell the most honest version of what those characters would be doing.
One of the things when I first heard the log line for Blackish, I thought, you go 5 degrees to the left and this is a drama.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if that was a question you had as you were coming up with the idea. Was it always a comedy for you? Because I know that's where you've worked, but given again, that's still something both kind of serious and painful for African Americans to deal with.
I think that that was it was a comedy of life, and I think that, you know, that intersectionality of tragedy and comedy has been what Black culture has been forever.
In fact, the kind of the opening preface that every show that the and I like this basically a film clip that sort of sets up what the story is going to be. Mm-hmm. That actually starts with something that's kind of almost always a tragic situation. Absolutely. And plays it for comedy. And I wonder when that came to you to do that.
Pretty early on, we felt like we wanted to set the thesis statement, never wanting to become a cliche, but we didn't want to, you know, and be formulaic. But we felt like, for us, this is almost an anthropological, you know, examination of Black family culture, you know. And so we felt like, in with that being said, the best way was to, in sort of talking to our audience, set the premise, you know, and say, like, we had a swimming episode, you know, and there has been so many misconceptions about Blacks and swimming, and some of them are, you know, some of the stereotypes are very on the nose.
We can go back about 4 years ago to a public pool being drained in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
After black kids got in the pool.
Dorothy Dandridge, who was the Beyonce of her time, got in a pool at a place she was performing and they drained the pool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we did an episode on swimming and we wanted to state the premise that this was something that has been talked about, but let's dig in and go to where this is coming from. You know, come from a situation in which we didn't necessarily weren't able to take in this country, we weren't able to really take dips too often in slavery, you know, and once we were, you know, given the, you know, put in our neighborhoods, you know, those houses were not necessarily built with pools. You know, so it was something we had to seek, you know, and in trying to seek it, you know, there were obstacles, you know, as you said, the pools being drained and funding leaving for, you know, the community pools and things like that. So there were a lot of things that really gave fuel to this stereotype. It wasn't just like, you know, we were lazy or, you know, not buoyant or whatever, you know, these, you know, things that were being said. So we wanted to say, like, let's sort of deal with that. Now, that doesn't answer why today we still aren't swimming, but, you know, in general. But, I mean, there's a sort of a legacy of it. And so our main character, Dre, didn't know how to swim, you know, and he didn't. He was sort of embarrassed because he felt like, you know, I should know how to swim, but he didn't want to say anything. So it helped to sort of set the premise, you know, because then it sort of gives context for this conversation, where the stereotype comes from, and you know, how it sort of is still being fueled in society today. And then we say, this is funny. You know, this is funny. How do we sort of make a comedy out of this? And because, you know, the great thing about comedy is it gives you a spoonful of sugar sometime to swallow the real tragic honesty of what we're talking about.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to the creator of Blackish, which is now in the third season on ABC, Kenya Barris. And do me a favor, tell me what your pitch was to ABC for Blackish.
We're all kind of taught to give our kids more than we have. That's sort of Black, white, Latino, whatever, Asian. We're taught to give our kids more than we have. But in doing that, what do your kids lose in the translation? And that's the sort of log line of the question that the series is. You know, I brought my kids up in a situation, you know, my wife's a doctor.
So the show, in a lot of ways, is autobiographical.
Oh, 100%. My wife's an anesthesiologist. Her name's Rainbow. She's biracial. I'm from Inglewood. The character's from Compton. You know, the pitch was he was a television writer.
Why did you decide to move to advertising?
Because we felt like that was a much bigger and broader way. That was, you know, Sami Fawvy and Jamila Hunter at ABC really gave us that sort of, that was their note that, you know, they felt like that was something that America understands an ad man. You know, I think Darren and Bewitched was an ad.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we've been and, doing, and Mad Men. Mad Men. We just never had a Black character in advertising.
Right. and that was from the inception of the pilot. You know,
in fact, that's what the pilot is about. You absolutely. Know, the whole thing about, you know, the nomenclature of urban.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was something that happened to me. It came from a story from me getting on a show as a writer trainee, you know, as the diversity writer And I wanted to be so happy to be on as a writer. And I realized when I got there, I didn't know that I had the diversity slot. I didn't know that I was the free writer. And I got there and I looked around and I was like, I'm the diversity. I'm the paid diversity writer.
You're the affirmative action
guy. I'm the affirmative action guy.
And so at one point they say to you, what, you know, Kenya, what does this mean?
That would actually happen.
They were like,
how would this character say hello? And I was like, I mean, good morning. And I was like, I mean, I don't know, man, probably just like that. But let me do some checking. And I had to have the conversation with myself, like, do you lose it? Do you have that moment where you lose it? Do you say something super smart back, you know, or do you use this as a teachable moment? And I used it as a teachable moment, which wasn't the best thing because...
But how do you win in that situation?
You can't. You know what I'm saying? The way that you win is win. The way that you win is move on from that situation, continue to elevate, and, you know, get your own thing and go back and use that moment so that when the person who said it to you happens to look at the show, they remember I'm the guy who asked him that. You know, like that's the best way you can win.
Well, we can look back at The Game, which at the time was the most successful show, the biggest rated show in the history of basic cable. And it was still treated like it was some kind of fluke and people...
Marbrock Akil, who created that, who's a friend and, you know, amazing writer and, you know, pretty lady and beautiful, you know, family. Her husband, Salim Akil, we all would sit around and talk. And I would go on hiatuses, you go look for jobs or you go pitch. And I'd walk in and we were all, you know, really proud. Salim and Mara had written and directed the pilot when we went and broke all those records. And we weren't on staff at the time, so we were all taking meetings. And I would walk in meetings, and they'd say, what show are you on? And I'd say, I'm on The Game. And they'd say, what show is that? And it was unbelievable to me because it had literally shattered viewership records. It shattered them. And shows like, you know, Girls or Nurse Jackie, you know, good shows in themselves, but like they get 700,000 viewers, you know, ratings that if The Game or definitely if Blackish they got would be immediately canceled. But a show that shatters ratings doesn't matter. And I had a friend tell me one time, you know, a friend who actually, you know, I don't think, you know, has anything malicious against me says, yeah, but those are all black people. And what that is, you know, it says so much in that. And it says so much in executives whose job it is to know television, not knowing what the show that had the highest ratings ever. It says that there was a qualifying to the quantifiable number that we were seeing in those ratings. And that said it all to me. And at that point, I really realized that it was a goal of mine to be on network television. It was a goal of mine to have a show that spoke to everyone.
My guest who has me angry and laughing at the same time is Kenya Barris. He's the creator of Blackish on ABC. We're going to take a break and come back with more anger and hilarity. The treatment is more to come.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back. I'm mad. It's The Treatment. My guest is the creator of Blackish, Kenya Barris. I'm so happy to have you here because this show gives you a chance to do so much. And so much of the show, too, is really about, for me, having this place where you can pretend that you're doing comedy. But strictly speaking, you're really not.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure, absolutely.
The fact is that everything I read about this show, I think, and maybe it gets back to what we were talking about before the break about if it's a black part and expression thing, then people sort of relieve it of having any complication. Mm-hmm. But it's a show that works in a really complex manner. Mm-hmm. And I think about the episode where, you know, there's a trial and go, he got off. Mm-hmm. And and the hugs and everything. And also what the parents mean. I mean, mm-hmm. What having both sets of parents mm-hmm. means for that family? Because it's about, finally, it's about trying to escape, but how far away do you want to go from what you are?
Sure. I mean, for us, it was really important. You know, Lawrence Fishburne doing comedy was an amazing sort of coup for us, but it was also really important to build that family generationally. You know, to see the older parents there, and they were divorced, but they still had their relationship. To see a set of parents, you know, in Andre and Rainbow who are married, and to see the kids, because every generation has a different relationship to the society in which they're actually in at that time, the place they're actually in at that time. And we wanted to, the biggest thing was to break out of the sort of box that we had been in of people telling us that we were monolithic as a voice of people, as the blacks had one voice, that we are, have so many layers of voices, so many different perspectives, so many different places we come from, so many different, you know, moments of context that give us relationship to where we're at in society. We wanted to show that. And the same thing goes if it was, you know, talking about, you know, a gay couple or talking about a Latino couple or talking about so many, when it's considered quote unquote niche shows, they give you one voice. And we were like, enough. You know, for us, it was about having different voices that had different points of view and making sure at the end of each show that we landed not necessarily in one place. We're not a teaching platform necessarily. We want to give, we're a conversation starter. You know, we want to talk about things to start a conversation. So we wanted to make sure we left people with enough different points of entry and access so that, that when they left, they could have a conversation that was just as layered and not, you know, one note as we had been given in our sort of.
Because I'm sure the fear was, and maybe the sort of idea in terms of network support was, well, you've got to make sure that people understand and learn something from this. And you just and what I like about this show is it's, in comedy terms, it's in constant motion. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example of that for me. The moment where Dre's father is talking to Rainbow's mother and basically busts her for having changed her name and having run away from what she is. Mm-hmm. But the show doesn't linger on it. It just keeps moving. And mm-hmm. I wondered if that was for you the way to sort of keep this so it plays, so it's got the kind of the lightness on its feet the comedy has to have, mm-hmm. but you're still dropping some knowledge.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of those things come from real life.
But also that idea of just keeping the velocity going.
Absolutely, because if you stay in one place, it becomes too preachy, too, you're trying to...
You don't want any awe moments on the show,
no,
do you?
No, we really don't. You know, I think that's, you know, it was very observational. Which, you know, we are definitely trying to further the conversation. And I think the way that you further the conversation is to not stay in one place too long, because then it becomes, here it comes again. You know, we kind of, you know, it's like a boxing match. You know, the jab is only used to set you up, you know, for the big hit, you know, and I kind of feel like that's what we're doing is, you know, we're keeping the jab going. And then every now and then we'll give a hook or we'll give an uppercut. But that's what we're trying to do is sort of keep them off their feet.
My guest, the Marvin Hagler of comedy, is Kenny Barris. We're talking about the show Black-ish. But I've got to say, one of the things I figured you must have really loved doing is the episode that ended the first season, which is basically a throwback episode. It's got mm-hmm. period stuff in it. And I'm sure you must have loved the idea of just getting a chance to do something. You could have your cast in period outfits.
Absolutely.
And have fun with it instead of having being... Because you never think about a black piece and it's set in a period. It's always tragic. There's mm-hmm. never anything funny about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, even life with Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence. They're in prison, for
right.
God's sake. So
right, right.
I figured that must have been like a really great moment for you.
That is absolutely for us. You know, that is something that the network is like, what? You know, we were like, those are going to be our finales. We want to play with sort of our place in history, and we want to sort of, you know, I loved Good Times, you know, and that was last season, and the season before we did the...
You did like a Good Times throwback episode.
We did a Good Times throwback. We actually built the set, and you know what I'm saying? I love the idea that that family was, every time something went right, here comes the wrong, you know what I'm saying? And we just constantly, like, that was sort of the running joke, that was the trope of the show, and I'm a huge Norman Lear fan, and first season was the Harlem Renaissance, which I just think was just an amazing period, you know, that so many from, you know, Langston Hughes and just so many people that came out of that period, like, they're still influences. And we have something that we want to do this year. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but we definitely are trying to play with that each year.
Okay, I was wondering about that. If you're treating each season finale as kind of a way to sort of break,
yes,
and do something as a departure from what the show has been doing.
That's
up
our
that
plan.
Point.
Yes, that's our plan. Is to sort of every year season finale, we want to sort of that's one for us, that's one for the writers and the directors and the actors. We want to sort of, you know, play dress up and sort of play with time and space and alternate realities and kind of take a look at where we're at, you know.
And one of the things that I really find so much fun about this show is that, you know, Dre is, relatively speaking, a kind of a normal guy, but his boss is almost a caricature,
sure,
of a certain kind of person who's so
entitled.
Wealthy and entitled and white that he doesn't even think about any repercussion of any act. I mean, every act has no repercussion for
right.
him.
You know, one of the things that was sort of hard, because a lot of times it's hard to go to work and home on a comedy show, I mean, on a family show, you know, kind of sort of to have a workplace scenario that comes home. A lot of, you don't really see that often. A lot of times you kind of make the shows within the house, you know, because.
Or within the workplace.
Within the workplace. You kind of choose one. So what we did with our workplace, we wanted to make that the sort of allegory for the world, you know, like they were the most, you know, heightened, stereotypical archetypes of what, you know.
White privilege.
White privilege could be, or complete just cluelessness, or that, you know, there's different people in that situation. And
and not that far from the truth, actually, in terms of a lot of people you meet.
It's so interesting.
I've met people like that who go, it's just really a degree of exaggeration.
Absolutely. It's not even a lot of hyperbole sometimes. It's really just like, it is, I have had so many things said to me when I'm in situations that it's like, did they really just say that? You know, like, and just clueless. And so we just now said, let's now take and make these guys cartoon characters that we can sort of get away with saying exactly what we're all really thinking that they were thinking. But, you know, we kind of can forgive them because they're not quite real people.
Because what the show is really about, as much as anything, is the oppression of black masculine archetype.
Oh, my God, it is. Let me write that down. That is absolutely... That is, I mean, it's, you know, going back to you, I was so honored to get asked to do this because I used to look at like Nikki Giovanni, you know, because she was herself, and she, but at the same time, she and spoke to us in a place that we, that could induce tears or fear or anger, you know, and, but at the same time, she spoke to everyone. And I, there were people like you in my life and the people, you know, Spike Lee, that, you know, was a pure voice that spoke to, that still spoke to everyone, that gave me hope that I could sort of be a voice that remained true to who I am, but still spoke to everyone, you know? And I kind of think that that is what I'm trying to preach to my children. You know, be proud of who you are. Be, you know your history, you know, teach your history, know what the world is. But at the same time, there is something really empowering when you can stay true to your voice and still speak to everyone. And that's a hard line to walk. You know, we are stylish, you know, as a people. We peacock, you know, we, you know, come from a line of people who are, you know, beautiful people. But at the same time, we have gravitas and we are intellects and we are people who have an intelligentsia to us, you know. And I feel like that's a line that I feel like I want to continue to sort of talk to young writers about, you know, young people who are going to college. We are bigger than they have shown us to be. And I think it's important to see people like you and people that can be true to who they are, but at the same time, speak to everyone. And that's what I want the show to be.
That's very kind, Kenya. Thank you so much for that. But the show continually deals in that. And I was thinking about the Daddy's Day episode,
mm-hmm.
and but also the continuing presence of Charlie, who is the most terrifying version of what a father could be. But also just, you know, when Dre's mom started dating a younger guy,
mm-hmm.
and his definition of black masculine, and now Rainbow's brother,
mm-hmm.
played by
D. Diggs.
So the idea of having this point where black masculinity is circled around Dre, who's kind of the island, and these two rivers are connected between Dre's father and his brother-in-law,
mm-hmm.
who find themselves agreeing about black masculine paranoia.
I know.
Was one of the funniest things I've ever seen on television.
I love that. And I really said when you, I wasn't kidding when I said, let me write that down. Like, it is defining black masculinity. You know, that is, Dre is the heart of it. And it is sort of like, what is that? You know, like really.
But he does want to be hard, and he wants to be black. But he's got, and he's got to drive his Benz. He's got to have 9 different APs to wear. But on the other hand, he wants to be a sensitive father who's not that embarrassed by his son, who's a nerd.
Yeah.
But he is, and but he loves his daughter, who's a peacock, but smarter than he is.
Absolutely. You know, like we have been taught, or you know, history has tried to teach us that we have to sort of be hard, you know, and be. You know, bear down. That's how you keep it real. But at the same time, you have children who may not be that. You have you work in a world where that may be feared if you're that. And so how do you constantly sort of go in and out of, you know, sort of being what you've been taught to be and being what you want to be or feel like you should be? And that even goes to, like, our relationship status. You know, the thing is when we're growing up, you know, you're taught to have game. You're taught to be a player. You're taught to sort of like, you know, how do you sort of get at her and how do you get at women? And
it's still what hip hop is about.
It is. But at the same time, you know, Jay-Z is married, you know, and he has a wife and he's supposed to be monogamous. And, you know.
And so is Kanye.
And so is Kanye.
But on the other hand, then you have Meek and yeah. Drake and Chris Brown. And I mean, this is, again, we're talking about the oppression of the black masculine archetype. It runs through hip-hop, and it one does. Is a response and the other is still living that life of being hard and being a player and flossing and all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so much of this is about is and then it really to me sort of is about choosing a path mm-hmm. and trying to figure out what part of that path is right for you mm-hmm. and going back to your metaphor at the beginning of the show, Dre can't stay in his lane.
Yeah. Because we, for us, I think our lane is much more of a twisting in and out U-turn, you know, road than for mainstream America. You know, I feel like my lane is, you know, my pants sag a little bit, you know, and I want to buy sneakers and I want to, you know, have jewelry. But I know what that image is. I have tattoos. But at the same time, I care about what my kids are eating at school. I care about my son, you know, feeling like he is empowered to be soft and considerate and thoughtful in the way that he is and like video games instead of basketball. You know, I'm back and forth between so many different versions of what exactly, who am I supposed to be in this world? And I kind of think what, you know, going back to what I was saying, what I've sort of landed on is I'm just going to be me. And I think that's what Dre battles with all the time is that at the end of the day, he's just going to be him. And that's the lane that we're sort of forging. And I think that's what makes, you know, I love black culture. And that's what makes us so amazing is that we are unbelievably adaptable. Adaptable to the point of causing envy. We know Rosa Parks took a stand for not wanting us to go to the back of the bus. If you're a black kid now, you ride the back of the bus. You know what I'm saying? Like we took, you know, the hardy weeds that were greens in slavery and the slop, which was chitlins, and we flavored it up and cooked it for hours, you know, in hours and learned how to make them soft and delicious and flavorful. And that, like that's the adaptability that causes the envy that I feel like has been like we're an amazing, amazing part of American culture.
Well, that's black culture, every part of the pig but the oink. We're out of time. My guest is Kenya Barris. He's the creator of Blackish. You're welcome back here anytime, by the way.
Oh,
thank
man.
You so much.
Thank
for
you
doing
so
it.
Much for having me. This is awesome.
This is really great for me. Let me thank our recording engineer here at NPR, Marcia Caldwell. Let me also thank Kat Yor, who mixes the show, Blake White, who's associate producer. I'm just Blackish, I guess. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes with The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.